Hi, everyone. I'm Hillary Kerr, and this is Second Life, a podcast spotlighting women who have truly inspiring careers. We're talking about their work journeys, what they've learned from the process of setting aside their doubts or fears, and what happens when they embark on their second life. Today, I am so excited to have Nancy Twine, the founder and CEO of high-performance clean hair care brand Briogeo. If you're not familiar with Briogeo, it's a really remarkable company that also happens to be the fastest-growing hair care brand at Sephora, plus it's carried at Net-a-Porter and Nordstrom. It's a truly inclusive line that works on all different textures of hair. It's formulated and manufactured in the United States and relies on natural oils, vitamins, and antioxidants instead of sulfates, silicone, and parabens. It's also cruelty-free, ethically sourced, and the packaging is both recycled and recyclable, so you can really feel good about using it. The company has also been profitable since year one of business, hit $35 million in revenue last year, and is on track to double that in 2019. Of course, since this is Second Life, you know that Nancy didn't start out in the hair care business. She actually used to work in commodity sales at Goldman Sachs before starting her company on the side. It's an amazing story of returning to your roots and building an incredible business along the way. Now, on Second Life, it's Nancy Twine. So, Nancy, we like to start at the beginning for this podcast. So, what did you study in school and what did you think you were going to be when you grew up?
Yeah, so I went to the University of Virginia, and they have a really good undergraduate business school. And I always knew that my heart was in entrepreneurism. Actually, when I was younger, I had all sorts of different businesses as a kid.
Really? Like what?
So it was funny. It was around the time the movie Clueless came out. And feather pens were like a thing. But this was before internet shopping and Etsy, where you could, you know, easily get your hands on one. So I actually learned how to craft feather pens. But it was like this little side hustle that I had in middle school.
That's so cool.
And then it evolved to crafts and jewelry. But I just always had this passion for creating, but also commerce. Like there was this validation that I got when someone actually wanted to buy and spend their money on what it was that I had to create. So I liked commerce, and there was a school of commerce at the University of Virginia, and they didn't have an entrepreneurism track, but the closest to it was finance. So that's what I ended up studying and majoring in.
And so did you think that you would at someday own your own business, or did you have more immediate goals?
Yeah. So I think my heart was always to be able to create and, you know, really kind of be the master of my destiny and kind of like owning my career situation. But, you know, coming out of school, I had no savings. I had college debt. And I learned that you could, you know, get a job on Wall Street and make good money coming out of school. So that's kind of really where I was focused.
Got it. So I read that your love of hair care actually comes from your childhood when you and your mom would make products.
Yeah.
Is that true?
It is. It is. So my mom was one of eight children, and she grew up in West Virginia. And my grandmother, you know, it was just a big responsibility taking care of eight children pretty much on her own. And she didn't have a lot of money or resources, so she kind of used this technique that my mom referred to as stretching. So the little bits of product that she had, lotion, shampoo, whatever it was, she would stretch them by adding her own essential oils and extracts. And kind of this idea of product chemistry basically in the kitchen of our home evolved into my generation. And my mom was actually a chemist. She was a doctor. And for fun, we would formulate a lot of our own beauty products using like just very raw ingredients that we would source from the local health food store. So things like oils and extracts and butters and sugars and salts to make our own body scrubs and face treatments. And it was this awesome, fun thing that we did that I just always loved.
A very fun hands-on project. So do you remember an early win or an early product where you're like, yes, this is something that I really love, or we really nailed it on this body scrub?
Yeah, actually, it was a hair care product. because I have very, and actually my hair used to be a lot more tightly coiled when I was younger, but super, super frizzy. So I remember we used like, it was like a shea butter base and loosened with, I think, maybe coconut or avocado oil. But we basically created like this at-home like frizz remedy for my curls. And it was very, very effective. But it wasn't like gel, because that's what people at the time were using to like defrizz their curls. They would just, you know, put in tons of like crunchy hair gel. Ugh. So that was a huge one for me. Yeah.
Got it. Okay. So you got your degree in finance. And then is that something that you would recommend for other entrepreneurs or?
Yeah. I mean, I think it really depends what industry that you're in. I know within beauty specifically, so many of my female founder friends are just such incredible creatives, from packaging to formulation. But I think where a lot of them get tripped up is the business side of it. So they either, you know, take on a co-founder that has the business savvy, or they try to do both. And it's really, really difficult. And I'm one of those weird people that have a very strong left brain and right brain. So I'm highly creative, but I also have a thing for like math and spreadsheets and numbers. So the creative part really came naturally to me, but I didn't really know much about finance in the business sense. So I knew that at some point, whether it was just navigating Goldman, where I first had my career opportunity, or later being an entrepreneur, I knew that it would benefit me.
Got it. Okay, so let's talk about that first job. Yeah. So you graduate from college, you decide to go to Wall Street, you decide to go, I'm going to New York, I'm going to work in this industry. How did you find a job and what was that first job?
You know, I knew that the undergrad business school was something that was like really unique at the University of Virginia. And I basically, you know, after I got in, I started just exploring career opportunities. And there was something that was posted on our internal message board about internships in finance. And I went to like an info session and did some applications. And I actually ended up doing 2 summer internships at Goldman before starting there full time.
Very wise. So you knew what you were getting yourself into.
Yes.
So what was that first job at Goldman like?
Yeah, so my first full-time job was in commodity sales and trading.
What is that?
I know, and something that I knew nothing about. It was definitely nothing that I aspired towards. I just kind of fell into it through the internship process, basically. One of my rotations was in commodity sales and trading.
And you liked it?
You know, I liked it and I didn't like it.
I was like, that was a very telling pause.
I liked it and I didn't like it. But basically, I worked on a team. It was the team that was responsible for helping North American corporate clients hedge their commodities exposure. So an example of that would be like, I don't know, Coca-Cola. So they use corn syrup and they use sugar to sweeten their beverages. And over time, the price of a can of Coke doesn't change too much. It's pretty consistent. However, the commodity inputs in that can of Coke can fluctuate like crazy. So basically what we would do is we would help Coca-Cola hedge their exposure to rising corn and sugar prices through the use of derivative products. Very complex stuff. Basically, it helped them to keep consistency within prices that were subject to triggering so that it didn't get passed to the end consumer.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So what does that mean on a day-to-day basis? Like what were your day-to-day responsibilities like that first year?
Yeah. So I was pretty much in a sales trading role. So I was responsible for watching prices of all different types of commodities, everything from agriculture to metals to natural gas, crude oil prices. And I had a client base and my clients were exposed to various different commodities. And part of my job was to really look out for them and understand how prices were changing, to make recommendations on when they should hedge and what types of structures that they should be using to hedge their various exposures. So I was doing everything from, you know, making prices in the markets alongside my traders to executing live trades, like where, you know, I was on a floor of a few hundred people standing up, you know, shouting over prices that were moving by the second and locking them in at the speed of light. It was pretty crazy looking back on it. It's like something you'd see in a movie.
I was going to say that must have been so exciting and there must have been so much adrenaline and also pressure that goes along with that. What is something that the movies get right about jobs like this and what is something that they get wrong?
Yeah. I mean, I think, too, just even for a female in that position, because, you know, pretty much my entire floor was predominantly, you know, male. And being a young woman of color on a trading floor in commodities and, you know, just also not only having the confidence that I knew how to do my job really well, but also having the confidence to, like, stand up and, like, speak out and, like, transact in front of tons of people who were watching. Like, you really build so many different skills beyond just learning your job. There's this whole, like, confidence aspect and learning to become fearless and knowing that, you know, sometimes you will make a mistake, but this too shall pass, and being able to move on really quickly. So I think, you know, oftentimes in movies, you see that kind of glamorous, fast-paced, you know, transaction kind of based energy. But what you don't see, too, is like a lot of the just personal emotion and development that goes into all of that. Like, I think about the person that I was when I walked into that job. It's completely different than the person I was when I left. There was so much just kind of emotional and personal development that went on during that process.
Interesting. So you were there for 7 years.
Yes.
You obviously were sort of climbing the ladder while you were there.
Yeah.
What were your next steps? Like, what from that first job, how do you progress, and what does progression actually mean in terms of responsibilities?
Yeah. So at Goldman, there was a pretty structured system where, you know, you came in as an analyst, and after a couple of years, if you did a good job, you got promoted to associate, and then people got promoted to vice president at various levels of years thereafter, just depending upon their performance. So I came in at 22 as an analyst, and I left at, I think I was 28 as a vice president. I think that progression for me just had to do with learning how to really stick it out during the tough times and, you know, just working so, so hard and believing in myself. And, you know, ultimately, when I started working on, you know, my business, there was this light at the end of the tunnel. There was something bigger that I was working towards. So those moments at work where I just wanted to break down and cry or say, I just can't do this anymore, I knew that there was something bigger that I was holding out for, and that made all the difference for me.
I can imagine that. So how long did it take from having this first idea of I might want to start my own thing to you starting to take action in that arena?
Yeah. So, you know, even after just a couple of years working at Goldman Sachs, like, I knew that this wasn't my future. And I'm not bad-mouthing my experience by any means, because I'm so grateful for it. And in retrospect, I wouldn't have changed anything. But it's really hard to find a future selling a product or, you know, doing things that you're just not passionate about. And there was a period in which I was just, you know, trying to figure out, like, what is it that I want to do next? And it was so hard for me to figure it out.
What was that process like? Were you taking interviews other places? Were you talking to people?
Well, like, in all transparency, like, I had a therapist. And, like, we were, you know, that was one of the things that we would just talk about every single week. It's like, what is it? What brings me joy? Like, what do I get excited about? And it was really, really hard for me to pinpoint it. And really, the moment of change for me came in 2010. I actually lost my mom really suddenly and tragically in a car incident. It was something that I couldn't plan for. It was just so unexpected. And it was the first time that I had lost someone so close to me. It was really the first time, too, that I realized, like, gosh, like, this life really isn't promised to anyone. And you just, you think day in and day out, you know, okay, I'm going to have my career and then I'll have a family and then, you know, I'll raise children and I'll retire. And you just kind of think that that path is just something that's going to happen. And so my whole perspective on life and the fact that it could be so short, you know, really changed. And it was at that moment that I think I got the courage to really, really focus on creating a better life for myself with respect to where I was spending most of my time, which was at work. And I wanted to be happy. And my risk tolerance just totally changed too. I was kind of like, I don't care. Like, I'm going to figure out what it is and I'm just going to do it. And if it doesn't work, you know what? So what? I'll figure it out. But I owe that to myself and to my life to, you know, give it a shot. And so it's really interesting because at the time, maybe a year or so before my mom passed, she was actually in the process of developing her own skincare line.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. And I remember, you know, kind of going through all of her stuff as we were just, you know, compiling things to put into storage and, you know, seeing early photography that she had put together and the packaging. And it lit something up inside of me because my mom, too, had this entrepreneurial spirit that I also have. But then it also just kind of took me back to my childhood of kind of, you know, mixing these like very basic formulas and kind of being my own beauty chemist in a way. And just something inside of me just sparked this idea of I want to start my own beauty product line. And I am very pragmatic about everything that I do. And I said, if I'm going to do this, I want to do the research. I want to understand the market. And at the time, there was this shift that was starting to happen in personal care, but it was really happening within mass beauty. So places like Whole Foods were starting to carve out shelf space for like natural personal care, not just food anymore. And I thought that that was really interesting. And in New York City, there's actually a small business library on 34th and I think Madison. And what's really cool about this library is with just a library card, you could actually get access to all of these research reports that you'd otherwise have to pay thousands of dollars for.
No way.
Yeah, which was so cool. And not only that, it was a time in which analysts were actually starting to report on the natural personal care market. So I actually had access to like data and information. And there were three things that I discovered in reading all of these different reports. So one was that this change was happening in mass, but it hadn't quite happened in prestige yet. The other thing that I noticed was that out of all of the sectors within beauty that were starting to see this evolution, it was, you know, personal care, body care, even makeup, but very little was happening yet in hair care. And then the third thing that I discovered as well was that a lot of these brands that were doing natural, they were kind of like conglomerate brands. So they were doing natural toothpaste and natural hair care and natural body care. No one was really specializing yet. So from that, I saw that there was this big white space in prestige, in clean and hair. And I decided, hey, if I'm going to like quit my, you know, great paying job at Goldman Sachs to do this full time, I want to be able to do something that I could be a dominant force in.
I love that the report led you to like, okay, this is the Venn diagram overlap of where the opportunity is.
Yes.
And you already had your own personal background in it.
Totally.
So you still worked for quite some time while you were formulating your company and working on Briogeo.
4 years. Yeah.
I didn't realize it was that long.
Yeah, it was 4 years. My mom passed in 2010, and it was kind of like that fall. I started ideating, and then I left Goldman in April of 2014. So
finance question for you, because what we like to talk about money on this podcast, mm-hmm. because I think women don't like to talk about money, and it's such an important topic. At that point, were you already starting to figure out a financial plan for yourself for funding and for being able to live, or did that piece come later?
It came about 6 months before I left Goldman, where things were starting to become real, because I actually had my first few retailers and I was actually, you know, transacting.
Wait, you were transacting before you quit your job?
Yeah.
That is very interesting and very smart.
Yeah, yeah.
So and you really wanted to cross every T and dot every I and make sure it was a calculated risk.
Totally. And I actually didn't quit my job until I got word that Sephora wanted to bring Briogeo in as their clean, kind of diverse focused hair care line. And I still have that email I received. And I still remember what it felt like to read that message because it was so transformational. And it was literally the jumping point of, you know, everything that has happened since.
So you do all of your research. You figure out your category. What happened next?
Yeah. So I had a business plan together, and I felt really confident about what it was I was going to do. And the next thing I needed to do was actually create product and, you know, figure out what my brand name was going to be and what the packaging was going to look like.
And who your lab was.
Yes.
And who you were going to work with on formulation. Because at what point, too, are you sort of parallel pathing the product development itself along with all of the sort of external packaging piece of it?
Yes, completely. So I think the smart thing that I did, and this was a piece of advice that I got from someone, because I think I originally wanted to launch with like 16 SKUs and someone said, no, like launch with a max of 4. Because diversity was a big aspect of Briogeo at the time and still is. And I said, well, how do I capture a diverse array of hair texture types with just 4 products? So basically, the 4 products that I launched was a universal shampoo that everyone could use. And then I had a conditioner for curly hair, a volumizing conditioner for fine hair, and then I had a deep treatment mask for people that had damaged hair. So that's kind of how I was able to bring diversity into just 4 SKUs. And once I knew how I was going to approach the initial assortment, I discovered that I actually didn't have to make the products in my kitchen, that I could actually team up with a contract manufacturer to help me do that. And not only that, a lot of these contract manufacturers had their own internal R&D teams that I could partner with on the development. And this was like, wow, I had no idea that existed. And so basically, I like went to Google and started Googling like hair care contract manufacturers in the U.S. And I got about 10 of them, and I put together a survey of questions that were really important that I wanted to vet with. And I ended up meeting some of the contract manufacturers at a trade show, and I narrowed it down to 1.
So what did you want with the formula? You said you wanted it to be something clean, but that means a lot to a lot of people. What did that mean to you?
Yeah, so...
And what does luxury mean to you?
Definitely. So I had to learn a lot about what I could and couldn't do with clean, because I actually remember in that survey that I sent around to all these contract manufacturers, I mean, I had such a long laundry list of ingredients I didn't want to use. And they said, okay, we could follow this, but it's probably not going to be such a great shampoo. It's probably not going to cleanse your hair very well, or it's probably not going to condition very well. And I kind of learned in the process, too, that it wasn't just about creating a line that was natural, but it was about creating a line that was safe and non-toxic. And I learned about, you know, safe synthetics and what that meant. Even certain, you know, coconut-derived surfactants. So the stuff that gets a clean shampoo to foam doesn't come straight from a coconut, but certain ingredients within that coconut are synthesized with other ingredients to give them that, you know, surfactant cleansing ability.
So cleaner living through nature and chemistry.
That's right. Exactly. A blend of both. Yeah.
So you had to educate yourself on
I had
all
to
that.
Educate myself to a different level than I did when I was growing up, because it was really basic stuff. I mean, we were just, you know, mixing oils and butters and salts together, which I don't want to take away from the genius of that, but... This was totally on a different scale.
So it sounds like you were getting pushback from some of the chemists and some of the manufacturers about,
yes,
no, we won't. How did you get to a place where you found someone who would innovate with you?
So one of the things that I've just learned in life is that passion is so infectious. And I think passion and excitement are, you know, they can be transferred to other people. And I remember that when I heard back from one of the contract manufacturers, I sent them kind of a watered-down version of my business plan. I didn't want to share too much. But I think just seeing the work and effort that I put into this plan gave them some hope that I wasn't just, you know,
wasting their time.
A dream. Exactly. And I actually remember visiting the facility in the Midwest, and I actually met with the CEO of the facility, and I shared my story. And I think he felt the passion. And, you know, it was only 4 products, so it wasn't anything too crazy. And there was also a new chemist who had joined the team. And I think that this was kind of this pet project for him too, you know, kind of coming in as a new chemist and being able to work on something, you know, very new and indie. I think it just excited people.
I love that. Yeah. So you're working on this, and at the same time, you're trying to figure out packaging and branding, and I'm assuming trademarking names and
yes.
all of that. How did that process work for you?
Oh, goodness. So packaging was really, really tough, because I would say that I was actually blown away by how much agencies wanted to charge me to do packaging design iterations, tens of thousands of dollars. And it was so daunting. And this is so funny. But I decided that I was going to try to do the packaging design on my own. And I started taking Photoshop and Illustrator classes, which was really helpful because now I know Photoshop and Illustrator. But I realized, actually, that was one of the first times that I realized, hey, I can't do everything. Because at the time, I was doing everything. But I realized that, like, I'm not a package designer, and I'm going to really need to invest in it the right way. And similarly, there was a blog that I was following called The Dye Line, and it's just all about packaging design. And there was a creative agency that was advertising on the site, and I reached out to them, and I shared my story, and they believed in me, and they were excited about what I was doing. And, you know, gave me a really decent rate and really helped me out. So I got lucky.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's, you know, but that's the thing, though. It's hard when you're young and scrappy and starting out and you don't have a lot of funding and all of that, but it just makes you more resourceful. And also, people are willing to take chances.
Totally.
You just have to connect.
Exactly.
Not everyone's going to take a chance on you. But if you keep trying, you will find someone eventually. You knock on enough doors.
That's right.
Someone's going to open it up.
That's right.
And then also, I want to know, how are you doing all of this while still having a full-time job?
I know. Well, you know, part of what fueled me, I mean, it was such a difficult time. And it was like, you know, work helped to take my mind off of so much.
Right.
But then the issue was, like, when I wasn't working, then my mind would go down all these different pathways. So having something to just pour my energy into on my nights and weekends was just so therapeutic for me.
And also something that's an ode to your mom in some ways.
Yes, definitely. So, you know, when you're so excited by whatever hobby or passion project it is,
it doesn't feel like work.
Exactly. Yeah.
So tell me about raising money. So at what point did you decide to do that?
Totally. So technically, in the world of VC and PEs, I haven't raised money, because the only little bit of money that I raised was actually before I had even sold a product, and it was by a small angel investor. But you know, my costs were starting to mount up. I needed to produce my first production run. I had a packaging design bill. There were a lot of stuff that were happening, and I was getting nervous because I was, you know, taking all this money from my savings. And I knew that I just needed a little cushion to help push the next stage through. And someone told me that given where I was in my trajectory, that angel investment fund would be right for me. And, you know, similar to kind of how I found my contract manufacturer, I started, you know, Googling, you know, angel investment funds in New York. And I actually grew up in Long Island, and I discovered the Long Island Angel Network. And I reached out to them about what I was doing. And they told me that each quarter they kind of had like this open mic where selected entrepreneurs could come and present their idea in front of their board. And, you know, I'd see what happened. So I applied and I got in. And, oh, my gosh, I remember this so vividly, running like a zip car and driving from right after work to way out in Long Island to go to this pitch summit. And this was before I actually had product developed. So I had this, like, big poster board that had from the designers like illustrations of what the packaging was going to look like. But that's all I had. And then like this little deck that I made based off of my business plan. So I show up to this auditorium, and the first thing that I took note of was that everyone who was sitting in the seats, they were all older men. There was like not one female in the room. And then I learned that all the entrepreneurs that were getting up on stage were all men. And not only that, they were all talking about these tech companies that they had started. So I was the only female and the only person, you know, doing something in the consumer products world.
Whoa.
Yes. So I was so nervous. I felt like it was such a bad decision. I hadn't done my homework, but I was there and I had to go through with it.
You had the zip car, you had the presentation,
yes.
You might as well just do it.
Totally. So I get on stage and I just give this really enthusiastic presentation about my product line. At that point, I knew that it was like over and I had nothing to lose. Like no one was interested in what I had to offer. So just go up there and just do it. And so I did it and I got a lot of blank stares and it was very anticlimactic. And after my presentation, there was a breakout room where all of the entrepreneurs had a little table where they could, you know, field questions from interested investors. And no one came to my table. And it was so embarrassing. And I was so hurt. I was so upset. But I said, you know what? Like, I kind of knew it as soon as I walked in the room. And as I was packing up, one man came by my table. His name was Phil. Hi, Phil. And Phil said, you know, I know nothing about hair care. Look, I'm bald. But you were the most enthusiastic presenter on stage. And here's my card. I know you don't have products yet, but keep in touch. And as you move further along in the process, I'd like to be able to help you if I can. And long story short, I kept in touch with him.
Angel Phil.
Yeah, like a true, true angel. He defines angel investor. And I kept in touch with him for that next, you know, year or so. And when we first got our purchase order, this was actually my first account was Urban Outfitters. He was so excited and he put in money the next day.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. That's incredible.
Yeah.
And that's the only fundraising you've done?
That's the only fundraising that I've done so far.
Wow. That's amazing. Okay, so you're working on everything. You're still working at Goldman.
Mm-hmm.
At what point do you decide to go out and start pitching it? And how are you doing that while still having a full-time job?
It was actually the summer of 2013. There was a big trade show that happens in Las Vegas called Cosmoprof. It's a huge convention where established brands and indie brands come and exhibit either, you know, new products or, you know, their brand for the first time. There's actually a section of this show called the Discover Beauty section. And that's actually what I applied to. And I got a little table. It was super expensive. It was like, I don't know, like $6,000. But I said, you know what, like this is the only opportunity for me to get in front of all of these different buyers at once. And, you know, everyone from like Nordstrom to Sephora, Urban Outfitters, Fred Siegel.
But at this point, is it still, it's just you?
It's just me. Yes.
So.
And one of my girlfriends came with me to help support.
You took time off work?
Yes. I took PTO. Yes. Yeah. So I get to the show and it was just, oh my gosh, it was so overwhelming. There were so many people. And by this point, I had done my first production run. And the manufacturer, I mean, they were so flexible. They let me, you know, manufacture a couple of hundred where, you know, typically a minimum is like 5,000.
But so you had a couple of hundred of the four initial products.
Yeah, but I only just, you know, I brought a few of each to the show.
Right.
And I had actually done my first photo shoot before that trade show. So I actually had some assets of the models. It was a nice presentation, I would say. And
you felt confident in what you were
confident.
Bringing.
Yeah, and actually also, I had my first sample packets made. So each of the four products, I had like little sample sachets to give out, which I gave out to everyone who came by. And so on the last day of the show, there was a group of women that came by my booth and they all had their name tags turned. So I had no idea who they were, but they were asking me about the brand because they had never seen it before. And, you know, I'm telling them the story. And then they said, okay, thanks. And they walked off. And I thought nothing of it. And then the girl at the booth next to me runs over and's just like, oh, my God, Sephora came by your booth. We've been waiting all weekend. And I was like, oh, my God, that was the Sephora team.
No wonder they had their badges
turned
around.
Yeah, exactly. And so I'm like, you know, like dying because I didn't get any business cards or anything. And I was like, oh, my gosh, that was the moment. And I don't know how to follow up with anyone. So I actually remembered that one of the key people who was in that group, her name was Margarita. It was like a very unique name. And I turned to Google again and did some research and found out who she was. She was like one of the chief merchant officers at Sephora. And when I got back to work that week, I emailed her And then I emailed her again and again and again, and she finally responded. And I basically told her that I was going to be in San Francisco and could we meet? And I wasn't actually going to be in San Francisco.
I was going to say, that sounds like a lie.
Yeah. And so she told me that she'd put me in touch with her junior buyer. And I went out there. We met for coffee. I was able to really tell her my story on a deeper level and what I was really trying to accomplish with Briogeo. And she said, Nancy, this is so awesome and I love it, but we're just not focused on expanding our hair care category right now. That was kind of a lot of what I had heard from retailers. They thought it was cool, but hair care and prestige just wasn't what people were focused on. I was a bit like, you know, ahead of the curve in that respect. Long story short, I did get a couple of retailers from that show, New Beauty at Fred Segal, Urban Outfitters. But 6 months later, I got an email from that merchant that really changed my life and said, you know, we just had a town hall and we're looking to focus on building out our diversity within hair care at Sephora. And we think that you and Briogeo would be perfect for the opportunity.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
And what's even better is that at that point, the training wheels were off. You had
yes.
Fred Segal, you had Urban, you'd had to deliver and
yes.
do all that. So you'd had some practice. At probably, I'm guessing, a somewhat smaller scale.
Yes, smaller scale.
But at least you'd gotten probably some feedback, I'm guessing.
Yeah, and just even the terminology and just how things, you know, special labels that needed to go on the case packs and how to create a packing list and, you know, how to read, you know, sell-through reports. Like, I had a nice little foundation for what I was going to really have to tackle next with launching at Sephora.
So then, is this the point where you finally quit?
This is the point that I finally quit. So literally, I got that email. And for me, it was so important, too, to just kind of get, like, the blessings and support of my family and friends. And I was so surprised because, you know, telling my friends and family that I wanted to quit this great opportunity at Goldman as a vice president to, you know, start—
A young vice president.
A young vice president, yeah.
A female vice president, which
yeah.
is even more important, too, to open those doors or continue to take up that space.
Yeah. And everyone was so supportive, and that's how I knew that I was making the right decision. And
so at this point, did you have like a direct-to-consumer website? Were you selling that way? Was that part of the build-out? What happened once you decided, okay, I'm all in, Briogeo, here I come?
Yeah. So actually, shortly after being at Cosmoprof, I did launch a website. It wasn't on such a great platform, and I knew nothing about like e-commerce and digital advertising, but...
Because it's so great now. I love the quiz.
Yes.
I like the fact that...
Oh, you did study our
yes.
website. Cool. Yeah.
I, too, do my research. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
What was that first iteration like, though?
Yeah. So it was a very basic website, and it had all of, you know, the model imagery that we had shot that summer, and there was no quiz, but there was a lot of education on the product pages because ingredient education and storytelling was so important to me. But it was really basic, and I knew nothing about how to drive traffic to the site. But I will say that things did start picking up for us on e-commerce when we invested in a PR agency and we started getting press. And I actually remember Gabrielle Korn, who's now at Nylon, she was at Refinery at the time. She wrote an article. She had just dyed her hair rose gold and wrote an article about how our Don't Despair Repair deep conditioning mask like saved her hair. And our site went bonkers. It was insane. And I still like thank her to this day because that was one of our earliest pieces of press that I think really helped to put us on the map.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
So you have this purchase order with mm-hmm. Sephora. They are investing in the space. They're clearly anointing you and saying, we want to really be a partner with you.
Yes.
What were the next 6 months, year like?
Yeah, so much of it was just learning. So when you even ship to Sephora, it is such a more complex process. There's something called EDI, Electronic Data Interexchange, something like that. But there are all these configurations that you need to connect with to the warehouse and to their systems. And when I just had Urban Outfitters and Fred Segal, I didn't need to have a warehouse. I actually had in New York, there's a company called Manhattan Mini Storage. So that's where I was storing the product.
And you're kidding.
Yes, that was my warehouse. I actually developed such close relationships with the guys at Manhattan Mini Storage because I was there like every single day. So I had like most of my inventory in storage, and then I had some in my apartment, my studio apartment. It was like insane. And then that's just how I would pack the orders. But
so you were doing it yourself?
I was doing it myself, yes.
But Sephora means no, you can't do it yourself.
Yes, exactly, because they wanted pallets of product. So just figuring all of that out was a big part of it. And then just learning more about like the technicalities of working with a larger retailer, testers and returns and damages and how to handle expired product. I mean, there was such a learning curve on an operational level that I needed to catch up on. And then there was also a learning curve on, you know, how to really drive customers to Sephora. And one of the things that we did early on that was so critical in our success today was sampling. I invested a lot in sampling. We actually did our first big sampling program with Ipsy in January of 2014. And, you know, it was like a couple hundred thousand units that we got out there in the hands of consumers of our hair mask. And that really helped to just build the momentum. And we just kept building and building on it.
And then at what point did you decide to start expanding your product offerings?
Yes. I think one of the things that's so special about Sephora is that they're not just a retailer. They are a brand incubator. And I'm so fortunate that I was able to get so much support from the merchants that, you know, helped to teach me about newness, because they were asking the question, like, when are you launching your next product? When's newness coming out? I'm like, oh, what do you mean? Like, what's the cadence for hair care? And I would say that when I first started rolling out newness, I was really conservative about what I was launching. It was like, okay, we had the volumizing conditioner as one of the first four. Now let's do the volumizing shampoo and the volumizing spray. And so that's kind of how we were rolling out. We were rolling out to create more comprehensive collections that could stand on their own. And once we did that is when all of the fun stuff really started happening with innovation. And I would say that that's what really helped to put Briogeo on the map as not just a clean hair care brand, but an innovative hair care brand and prestige.
What are you most proud of?
Well,
in that department?
I think what I'm really proud of is the Scalp Revival collection that we launched in April of 2017. We were the first brand to launch a full, you know, scalp assortment within prestige, powered by charcoal, which charcoal hadn't been used in prestige hair care. And I'm fine telling you this because I've kind of joked about it with Sephora a lot, but I think they were really hesitant about me launching scalp. And then also launching this gray looking goop that the client was going to be confused. Scalp wasn't sexy. No one was talking about it. It was a huge risk, but I saw such a big white space. I'm like, everyone that I know that has scalp issues, whether they, you know, want to admit it or not, I mean, they're going to mass and they're buying, you know, Head and Shoulders or Neutrogena T-Gel. And I was like, I can't believe no one's really owning this in prestige. And I took the risk kind of a little bit against Sephora's warmest support because I truly...
That's so delicately put.
Because I truly believed in it. And actually that next year we ended up winning the Sephora Innovation Award, which was super, super cool. So I think one of the reasons why that is my most favorite launch is because it was kind of the first time as an entrepreneur that I really took a risk against maybe, you know, what experts in the field had, you know, encouraged me to do.
You have to listen to your gut.
Totally.
I think that's such a huge part of it. Obviously, making informed decisions, sure. But sometimes there's just this thing inside you that says, do this or don't do that, mm-hmm. even against conventional wisdom. And it's such a rewarding feeling.
It is.
When it pays off.
Absolutely.
What are some of the skills from your first life that you use on a daily basis now with Briogeo?
I think one of the things that I am most grateful for about my time at Goldman is that I worked with some of the smartest people I've ever met in my life that literally taught me how to think strategically. And that is so much of what I spend my time doing now, less tactical stuff because I have a team, but really helping them to, you know, think strategically about the business. Also just helping to inspire them. I feel like you get the most out of people when they are inspired and motivated. I want them all to feel a sense of ownership that they're really building this with me. And really that sense of teamwork and collaboration is something that I learned about early in my career, and I really realized the power of it.
So on that note, what kind of boss are you, and how have you learned to be that kind of boss? Because I think it's a very, at least it was a very sharp learning curve for me.
Yeah, it was very difficult for me also, because I will say when I was at Goldman, I really didn't manage people. I had people that I reported into, but there wasn't really like a hierarchy below me. And I had to learn so much of it as I went. And I will say, you know, there was definitely an evolution. I've always had a lot of vision, and I've always been a believer that if you work hard and you stay focused, you can make anything happen. But I think at the same time, you have to balance that with a sense of empathy for your team and realizing that not everyone, you know, has that same mindset or ability from the get-go. And part of my job is to really help foster that and really understand the talents of my team and making sure that they're in positions within the company that really help those talents to shine. And then the other aspect is just really, again, taking the energy that I have for what I do and using that to really help motivate and inspire others.
Got it. So one question I always love to ask on this podcast is about advice. So a lot of the people who listen to this podcast, maybe they're in their first career, maybe they're aware that there's something else out there, they're trying to figure out what their next step is, but maybe they're a little bit afraid of taking that big leap and they don't know how to get started or they don't know when it's the right time to actually make the move. So what advice would you give someone who is interested in either switching lanes in their career or just evolving into a different aspect of their career?
Yeah, it's a really great and also complex, question to respond to. But I think some of the nuggets that really helped me was really doing your research is so, so important. I think sometimes people get so energized by an idea and they just want to jump right into it. But taking the time to really understand what exists in the market already, because I've had friends that have had these great ideas and invested a lot of time and money only to realize that something very similar existed, which is okay, but they hadn't thought out their plan for differentiation well enough to be able to tackle that and to compete in that space. So I would say research is very, very important. Networking was so important for me. I think every industry has their own set of trade shows or organizations where you can just find people who are doing what it is you want to do. And being able to learn from them or to get resources, you know, don't use this warehouse, use that one, you know, lots of those little nuggets really kind of add up to helping you avoid some of those early pitfalls. And then the next part of it, which I think is just, you know, true for anyone, is just knowing that you're going to face challenges and trying to do whatever you can do to prevent them, whether that's sticking with your job another year just so you have enough savings to get you through that, you know, first challenging year. But even beyond the things that you can plan for, you're always going to have curveballs. You're always going to have disappointments, things that don't go your way. And it's those things that weed out most people from getting to a point of success. Like part of having a high probability of success is just staying in the game and not becoming weak because of those curveballs that get thrown at you, but just using them as, you know, sources of motivation to just push harder. I see that happen sometimes where people get thrown off and say, oh, you know what, this probably just, you know, isn't part of my fate. It's just, it's not working. But sometimes it's going to feel like it's not working. Keeping down the path, working hard, staying true to your vision, I think is so key.
I also think it's important to talk about failure because we like to present ourselves and our careers in this Instagram pretty filter version, and that's not real. So can you tell me a little bit about a moment that was really challenging in your career and what you learned from it?
Yeah. So I would say there was, you know, a period of a few years where I was really trying to figure out how we were going to enhance our brand awareness, how we were going to stand out, you know, within the pool of established prestige hair care brands. I think a big part of kind of overcoming what could have been failure was really just staying true and continuing to believe in the things that we were doing right, whether it was sampling or taking client service really, really seriously, or, you know, thinking about ways that we could really partner with our key retailers like Sephora to enhance our visibility.
Got it. Okay. So what are you working on now? What are your upcoming goals? What can you tell me?
Yeah.
What can we look forward to?
Totally. There's so many things to look forward to. I mean, just within the past 6 months, we've actually gone global with Sephora. So we are in Sephora Middle East, Southeast Asia, Australia, New Zealand, France. I mean, that's been huge. That's such a new challenge for the company, you know, understanding how those markets operate and how do we, you know, once again, start from scratch and figure out how to really build within those new territories. So that's really exciting. And then in January, we launched a new category called Be Well, which stands for Briogeo Wellness. And we launched a organic cold-pressed castor oil and steam-distilled tea tree oil, which are doing phenomenally well. And in the fall, we're going to be extending the assortment with ingestibles and other really innovative topicals. I'm really excited about it for several different reasons, but I think most importantly, I've always thought about clean and ingredients as not just being relevant to hair care, but really our whole beauty and wellness ritual. And it's been really cool to see, you know, over the past year or so, this wellness kind of category emerging. Like, how cool is it that it's a trend to like focus on being good to yourself? And I think we've built a lot of trust amongst our consumer base with hair care. And I'm really excited for them to see what we have up our sleeves with wellness.
Excellent. Well, Nancy, my last question is my favorite question. If you could go back in time and speak with your younger self, what advice would you give her?
I think the biggest piece of advice that I would give myself is, you know, this too shall pass. I think that there have been so many instances, and still it even happens now sometimes, where you just kind of focus on, you know, things that didn't go right, whether it's work-related or even personal. And sometimes that could just pull in, you know, not so great energy into your mindset, into your headspace. And rather than, you know, spending so much time focusing on the what-ifs, you know, just quickly moving on, because it all does pass. And not only that, at least in my situation, it's all kind of evolved to the better. And I always tell myself that now, but especially my younger self, all of the small stuff that I sweated back then, you know, really kind of was part of what I needed to go through and learn to get to this point. So I think that that is a very important piece of advice that I would have given myself.
Sweat the small stuff until you don't have to anymore.
Exactly.
Well, Nancy, thank you so much for taking the time to sit down and talk with me. This was so incredible. I'm so proud of you and excited for you.
Thank you.
This is such an incredible company, and I am rooting for you.
Thank you so much.
That was founder and CEO of Briogeo, Nancy Twine. For more inspiring interviews with women like Nancy, head on over to secondlifepod.com, where we have so many more for you to peruse. If you like today's show, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts or iTunes or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to rate and review us. It only takes a moment and it means so much to us. We love seeing you spread the word on social, and now you can tag us in your posts. We are at Second Life Pod on Instagram and Twitter, so follow us, come say hi. We always love hearing from you. We also always want to know who you'd like to hear from on this show, so send in your request to hello@secondlifepod.com, or you can just DM us. I'm at Hillary Kerr. We are at Second Life Pod. Our DMs are always open. I'm Hillary Kerr, and you've been listening to Second Life.